Welcome to Agency in Focus, Department of Homeland Security, sponsored by Leidos. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
Noah was about the last person on Earth to get an early enough warning about an impending flood. For the rest of us, floods do billions of dollars in damage and hardship every year. And one way to mitigate flood damage and loss of life is earlier warnings. Now the Homeland Security Department's Science and Technology Directorate is working on technologies to enable earlier flood warnings than is now possible. Joining me with the details, Program Manager David Alexander. Mr. Alexander, good to have you on.
Thank you.
Tell us about this program. I guess it's taking place out west as kind of an experiment.
We have in DHS&T a larger program called the Flood Apex, and it's looking at a mix of technology solutions that can improve the way we respond and recover from floods. We have a variety of community pilots. We have a significant pilot out west with the Lower Colorado River Authority that looks at exploiting some of our new science and technology, provides us kind of a proving ground and a way to validate as well as refine our research objectives and obtain the outcomes that we would like to see in terms of reducing our risk and losses to floods.
Is that the basic objective, though, is to get earlier warnings of flood on the theory that that can save lives and maybe mitigate the damage?
Yes. Early warning, monitoring, and detection is a key component to addressing the losses and damages and fatalities and costs of floods. It also provides us meaningful data and useful data in terms of informing risk reduction and mitigation strategies. We don't always want to be in the response mode. We would like to strengthen communities' resilience to flood risk up front, be better prepared, and not always responding to the hazard at hand.
How does this all work?
So we have a variety of things that we're pursuing and different technologies. Some of those technologies involve the development of new sensors and alerting protocols. Some of those are looking at low-cost, more affordable, and adaptable, scalable sensors that will detect rising water in a variety of use cases, and then communicate that information that then can be broadcast to those that are most at risk. Some of those sensor technologies involve not just deploying the sensor on a dam or levee, as many people would often associate the risk to, hey, flooding is occurring along our streams or along our coast from hurricanes. We have a much more significant and growing risk around urban flash flooding. Heavy precipitation, impervious surface. To move the water out, we're relying on stormwater systems and the ability of the soil to absorb the flow of water. Therefore, we have the occurrence of inundation in areas that we don't typically associate with flooding. We have low water crossings, driveways that just happen to transit in low elevation areas. We have road intersections that get inundated during heavy precipitation. So if we can start to deploy more affordable rising water flood sensors in areas that aren't just along the streams, we get two benefits. One benefit is we could quickly identify a risk and then communicate to those that are most in danger. For example, the emerging smart car autonomous vehicle market. That sensor could detect if there's rising water ahead. It could then notify an oncoming car to take precautions, take an alternate route, reduce its speed, and reduce the significant number of fatalities. We could also use those sensors to then communicate to our predictive analytic engines additional information that will then allow us more accurate, precise understandings of how to communicate larger warnings, and then that would in turn inform mitigation investments on where do we need to do additional flood-proofing investment for a community.
David Alexander is manager of the Flood Apex program at the Homeland Security Department's Science and Technology Directorate. I'm Tom Temin.
For 15 years, Leidos has seen firsthand the Department of Homeland Security's men and women safeguard the American people, our homeland, and our values. In support of the DHS mission, our technical experts have delivered trusted solutions in mission-based IT, cybersecurity, biometrics, and logistics. Ranked number one on Washington Technology's top 100, Leidos has the experience DHS can count on, and we're ready for your future missions. Learn more at Leidos.com/homeland.
We're speaking with David Alexander. He's manager of the Flood Apex program at the Homeland Security Department's Science and Technology Directorate. So in other words, if you have certain rain conditions that are known to possibly cause flood, and you could get a sensor that says this intersection or this low area is wet, you know, 3 hours into the rain or something like that, I'm just making this up, then that would be a better indicator that, yes, this is going to flood, and you can keep people from driving in there in the first place.
That, not only knowing that it's wet, but also being able to meter that the water is rising and continue to rise at that intersection and posing more and more of a hazard. We also have, you know, sensor innovation work we're doing on how do we improve stormwater management. Those are the systems that absorb the water that is flowing off the streets and being discharged away from property and infrastructure. Much of that water flows through culverts. Well, many of us know culverts get covered with debris and obstructed. If those culverts are obstructed, then the water can't flow into the water storm water system. It continues to pool and flow onto the road or overflow into property. So by having better sensing technology that can also detect those types of obstructions, we can also look to improve the movement of water, which would allow for safer conditions within the community. We're not going to stop the rain, but we can better manage the water that's occurring from that rainfall.
Yeah, sounds like my gutters. And what format do these sensors take? Are these things that can be put on the ground or mounted on poles in some way? And how does it all work technically?
Yeah, the goal is to get it to a small form factor that is weatherproof, is multimodal, meaning it will use different types of communications in case there's a obstruction to its communications channel. For example, maybe the wireless broadband is obstructed, it can use satellite communications. It may be able to use radio frequency communication like Bluetooth to communicate to an oncoming vehicle, for example. In terms of where we see these sensors being mounted, we see them being able to be free-mounted, mounted on critical infrastructure. Those could be roads, bridges, poles, other buildings, other types of locations or venues. So we see a mix of ways that you can deploy the sensor. Where we're at in this stage is really starting to hone what those use cases are and how the form factor should be shaped so that you can both get it down to a lower cost and price point, but also make it easier to deploy and more durable to those environments.
Is there any commercial version of this type of technology available, or are you working with researchers and building prototypes at this point?
We are working with small businesses. We have several small businesses that we awarded small business innovative research projects to. Those are in their second phase, so they've moved beyond their prototype and are starting to develop their production models, given specification targets that we defined in the award process. And they are leveraging additional research and innovation that we're doing with other partners and labs. They're just not out there on their own. We do bring additional innovations and capacities to the table as DHS and the federal government.
Sure. And just a curious question, can you measure water and the change in water levels with a sensor that doesn't get wet? In other words, does it have to be submerged, or can it look at the water and see what's going on?
Yeah, the new technology we're looking at, it will not be a submerged sensor. It will use remote sensing type technology, similar to things like sonar and radar or acoustic, to detect changes in water conditions. But we also are looking at, you know, driving additional innovation and modularity so that we can detect things like flow rate, soil moisture, and other conditions as well. For those sensors to really get to a lower price point and make it marketably viable, we want to drive additional use cases for those sensors.
What could some of those potentially be?
So for example, like I said, if those sensors could detect soil moisture, then they could be used by the agricultural industry to also provide information on whether or not they need to do additional irrigation to their crop. That's another example of how the sensor could be utilized. So it's not just, you know, let's wait for a flood. Could we start to pressure sensors that could be put into daily use for other scenarios.
And over time, this type of network would generate a large amount of data. And do you see that possibly analysis of that data could yield new wisdom once you've got it aggregated, say, from 50 floods?
Absolutely. So we see that the data that these sensors are sensing combined with other parts of the weather and flood sensor network would provide us additional analytics to both refine our models that then drive predictions on when we think flooding occur. It could drive decisions that we make in terms of local land use and building codes, investments in new mitigation, as well as it could start to inform, based on understanding what's being flooded, new product and innovation and flood proofing. That's another aspect of the program. Can we start to cultivate new products that if a location is going to experience some type of temporary flooding, can we flood proof that location with new types of products, maybe new sealant products that you can put on the exterior of that location to allow it to absorb and handle that temporary inundation of water without being destructive in nature. So there are other aspects that the sensors could start to contribute to in terms of stimulating new innovations, new ideas, and new products.
David Alexander is manager of the Flood Apex Program at the Homeland Security Department Science and Technology Directorate. Thanks so much for joining me.
It's been a pleasure.
Find a link to more information and to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
For 15 years, Leidos has seen firsthand the Department of Homeland Security's men and women safeguard the American people, our homeland, and our values. In support of the DHS mission, our technical experts have delivered trusted solutions in mission-based IT, cybersecurity, biometrics, and logistics. Ranked number one on Washington Technology's top 100, Leidos has the experience DHS can count on, and we're ready for your future missions. Learn more at Leidos.com/homeland.
Work never stops for the Homeland Security Office of Inspector General. Two recent investigations found some common problems, weaknesses in IT systems or procedures for managing basic functions. For details, we turn to Deputy Inspector General John Kelly. Mr. Kelly, good to have you on.
I'm glad to be here, Tom.
And let's talk about the first report, and that has to do with the Coast Guard's, I guess you would call it the equivalent of the Internal Affairs Department, but it's, what is it called? Coast Guard Investigative Services.
Correct.
And you found some issues with their case management there. What's going on?
Yes, Tom. The audit of the Coast Guard's Investigative Service, we found significant issues with its case management system. While we generally were able to determine that the Coast Guard conducted its investigations expeditiously, we did identify significant issues with their case management systems. Those problems prevented us from making substantive observations concerning the quality of their investigations. This is extremely disturbing because if we could not make those observations concerning the quality of their investigations, neither could Coast Guard management.
So is the problem that within the case management system there's just not enough information about the cases and how they investigated them and what they determined?
There are a myriad of problems associated with the system. We found it to be very awkward and clumsy. There was not adequate information or guidance as to what they were supposed to be putting into those systems. We also found inconsistencies in how people put information in there, which is a logical outflow when people are not being told what to put into the system.
So, in other words, there's nothing there that management could mine to get a sense of the trends in what's going on with their investigative service.
That's very correct.
And what is the give us an idea of the volume of cases that they handle at the Coast Guard?
Actually, I don't have those statistics off the top of my tongue, but the Coast Guard has more than 50,000 people working for them, and they're scattered throughout the country. So I would venture to say that there's a fairly large number of cases that are involved with that.
Is there, you know what, I'm just going to take out that whole set question and answer. If you don't have the numbers, we don't need to do that. Is there some other case management system in use somewhere at Homeland Security that the Coast Guard could simply adopt? I mean, isn't that the goal overall for management, is to try to make one DHS?
It is. It would be nice if we had one system for everything. Agencies need to modify their system for their activities. The Coast Guard is both a law enforcement and a military organization. So they have certain requirements and certain additional needs that are not within the other law enforcement type entities, such as CBP or ICE.
So given that, even with respect to the Department of Defense, they're unique.
That is correct, yes.
What about, say, the investigative services that the Defense Department agencies
for
operate?
DCIS and NCIS, they could look to see see if they can adopt those systems. However, part of that evaluation that we conducted did not go and look to see whether or not that was a better system.
What were your main recommendations?
We had a total of 32 recommendations, three of which we closed upon the issuance of the report, because the Coast Guard actually concurred with all of our recommendations. They realized that they had to take some corrective actions. They also provided us information as to how they were going to address 19 other of those recommendations that we believe will address the shortcomings that we identified. But there are also 10 other recommendations that the Coast Guard still needs to come up with a better plan to resolve some of those problems.
So you had some recommendations with respect to the system itself, but also I noticed there were quite a few with respect to management of how they ingest and handle cases.
That is correct.
For example, the need for a hotline.
Yes, and also for controlling the referrals on hotlines, making sure that they're supposed to, by statute, send a lot of those hotline referrals to the Inspector General's office, to us. But they did not have they couldn't even tell us which ones that they referred to us and which ones they did not.
So they've got some work to do.
They do.
We're speaking with John Kelly, Deputy Inspector General at the Homeland Security Department. And the other report I wanted to ask you about concerned the Science and Technology Directorate's financial statements, and in particular the information systems that support their finances. You found weaknesses.
Yes, we did. That was part of a much larger report that we do every year on the financial statements for the entire department. We hire KPMG to actually conduct that audit for us. For this year, KPMG provided a unmodified or clean opinion over the financial statements, but they also provided a disclaimer of opinion on the internal controls that were used to generate those systems. What that means is that the information that were used to come up with those financial statements were not reliable, and both the CFO and the inspector, or KPMG, had to basically take Herculean efforts to make adjustments to the financial systems so that they could have reasonable assurance that the financial statements were presented fairly as of September 30th, 2016.
Well, is that a problem with the composition of the software and the system itself, or is it the information people are putting in there?
Both. People are not putting accurate information in there. They're not putting it in there on a timely basis, and sometimes they're putting it in there incorrectly.
And there's no back check, I guess, against what people are putting in?
Unfortunately, no. That's where the problems are with the internal controls. That there's no one adequately supervising and making sure that things are put in there correctly, and if they need to be adjusted, they're adjusted on a timely basis. This is a systemic problem that is fairly universal in the government. When they passed the CFO Act a couple decades ago, the emphasis on the CFOs were primarily to get clean opinions. They didn't really care that much or haven't put enough emphasis into making sure that the internal controls were in place and the financial systems were available or accurate so that their day-to-day decisions could be based on accurate information.
So in a worst-case scenario, then, someone in the financial function could ensure that the data put into the system would produce an unalloyed audit, but wouldn't necessarily be the information regarding what actually happened financially.
Ultimately, with some of the adjustments that are made, they were able to make those adjustments so that the auditors had reasonable assurance the information was presented fairly, but that had to take a lot of adjustments and reconciliations that basically mean that the information that was provided initially was of limited value. That's why they received an adverse opinion on their internal controls.
I see. So if they could somehow, so what do they need to do then to get the system up to snuff so all those reconciliations and back checks don't have to be done?
They need to, get, as you mentioned before, one system throughout the entire department so that they talk with each other. They need to get controls in place to make sure that the information is timely and accurate and reliable.
And I'll ask the same question that I asked about the Coast Guard. Is there another financial management system in another DHS directorate, say, I don't know, National Programs and Protections, that science and technology could use, and they'd be all set to go?
The goal is to get one system throughout the entire department, using another component system to replicate that would not really do the get the job done, because there are seven main components and then another more than a dozen headquarters offices. We actually need one system department-wide.
Sounds like a good case for shared services.
It does.
John Kelly is Deputy Inspector General at the Homeland Security Department. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Find links to both reports and to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Agency in Focus, Department of Homeland Security, sponsored by Leidos, on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search DHS15.
For 15 years, Leidos has seen firsthand the Department of Homeland Security's men and women safeguard the American people, our homeland, and our values. In support of the DHS mission, our technical experts have delivered trusted solutions in mission-based IT, cybersecurity, biometrics, and logistics. Ranked number one on Washington Technology's top 100, Leidos has the experience DHS can count on, and we're ready for your future missions. Learn more at Leidos.com/homeland.